One of the advantages of my current work schedule is that when Blog Talk Radio shits the bed, as it did last night at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we can reset, we can re-huddle and re-engage at 3 o'clock in the afternoon for a special edition of Long Road to Ruin. Hello, I am your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And this is a second attempt, count them, second attempt, at our look at one of the silliest trilogies in the history of movies, Darkman. It's good to be back. We took a couple of weeks off for various reasons, but we're back in the saddle again. I'm not going to play the Aerosmith song. Let's just get on with this. And speaking of getting on with this, let's get off this, get on the right track, get on the, oh, how does that cracker song go? It doesn't matter. I don't even know if he listens to the band. Ladies and gentlemen, a better wordsmith than I, Mr. Sean Comer. How do you do, sir?
Welcome to the WGN Lunchtime Movie. Hi, everyone. I'm Sean. You're not. You're welcome for that fact because it means you don't feel like you have termites clawing their way up the back of your throat. I'm at Starbucks. There is traffic, including what appeared to be a beetle driving by with a turbocharged engine just now. Phoenix, everyone. It's good to be back. It's good to have my voice back. It's good to not be hawking up internal organs anymore, but to have it just be down just a nice dry tickle at the back of my esophagus. And really nice to be talking about one surprisingly pretty good movie and two other things that happened.
The original Darkman is better than it had any right to be. And we're certainly going to talk about that. One of the reasons
hey,
why
Mark, Mark, before we get into that, I got a question for you.
Okay.
Is that an instant message tone that I'm hearing on your end, or is that my phone that's doing that?
A few seconds ago, that was me.
Okay, that was you. Okay, I wasn't sure if that was mine or not. I forgot to turn the Do Not Disturb feature on before we get on the air, which I'm going to do right now while you're introducing the movie.
So, when asked, how do you pick the franchises that you do? What makes you decide you're going to do this or that? I try to look for trilogies because, they make for good single episodes. I also look for things off the beaten path. I don't want to just keep doing comic book movies over and over and over again. Funny, that sort of begins our look at Darkman tonight. But I also like to, dig into Netflix and Amazon Prime and see, what are some of maybe some missed franchises that people didn't know about or things that people didn't know were franchises? Sure, people saw Darkman to become a cult classic, but I bet you didn't know that there were two direct-to-DVD sequels. In fact, there's even, and Sean can talk about this for a little bit, there's even some weirdness with how they were released. They actually were released out of order, oddly enough. But there's also, and I've talked about this before, one of the reasons why I do Long Road to Ruin is that it gives me an opportunity to watch movies I might not otherwise spend time doing. And I've seen the second one, The Return of Durant, obviously didn't speak to me. But when I would look through movies, look through Netflix queues and all that, I would see Darkman 3, Die, Darkman, Die. And it piqued my curiosity, to say the least. And I have been wanting to watch this movie for a long time, because I find that title hilarious. And I got an opportunity to watch it yesterday in preparation for this show, and it did not disappoint. I know, we're going to talk about how the sequels definitely fall off in terms of quality from the original, believe it or not. But for the second one, The Return of Durant, that's absolutely true. The third one actually has a charm to it. It sort of reaches for the brass ring of quality that the first one has, and it just misses it by maybe an inch, whereas the second one literally just happens. It's one of the reasons why we're only going an hour today, because it's literally, we have a lot to say about the first one and nothing to say about the second one. And the third one, I'm going to tell Sean how many times I giggled like an idiot watching it. and I wasn't smoking pot at the time. So, Sean, reach into the history books, into the Wayback Machine, and give us the goods. What makes Darkman Darkman? Where did it come from, and why is it something we're talking about today?
The first movie is one of the most genuine rarities that you'll see in all of major Hollywood cinema. It is, for all intents and purposes, a just about 190. We'll call it a 90% original superhero story, in that it didn't come from a major publisher like Dark Horse, Image, Marvel, or DC. In fact, if you watch the movie and you think to yourself, huh, this is kind of like The Shadow meets Batman, well, there's actually a very good reason for that. It's because once upon a time, director Sam Raimi ran into a bit of a problem. He couldn't secure the rights to make a film for either franchise. So what did he do? He had him a little Bender-bending Rodriguez moment and essentially said, oh yeah, I'll make my own Shadow movie with blackjack and hookers. What he instead was able to strike a deal with Universal Studios to get his very first ever Hollywood studio film made as an adaptation to what was actually a short story. Along the way, it kind of ended up ultimately being a precursor somewhat of a foreboding warning of what would come of his future in comic book movies, and that was Universal ran him absolutely through the ringer while he wrote the screenplay. The whole thing was fraught with post-production challenges from the studio and grueling notes throughout the scripting process, but ultimately it panned out well enough. He managed to snag Liam Neeson years before Taken would transform him into a full-fledged action star, put him into the lead as Dr. Peyton Westlake, managed to snag Larry Drake to play murderous mobster Robert Durant, and a younger Francis McDormand to play Westlake's girlfriend. And ultimately, what we ended up with was a movie with a $16 million budget that ultimately earned $49 million worldwide, more than justifying two sequels that unfortunately might have played a little bit better had they been released in order. That's right. Unfortunately, after they were produced, Die, Darkman, Die was supposed to be the immediate follow-up to Darkman, and The Return of Durant was supposed to be the conclusion of the trilogy. They flip-flopped them, and as a result, Die, Darkman, Die, ultimately, while an admirable effort, just ends up feeling kind of anticlimactic. However, as the years have worn on, this movie has proven to be an interesting cult classic. You see, it came out at a time when 90s comics had not yet reached the apex of their dark, violent, anti-hero fascination, but this did come out 2 years before the film version of The Crow hit cinemas, and 4 years before Spawn became the world's best-selling comic, and quite easily the most successful character to ever not come out of Marvel or directly from Marvel or DC. So, in a way, you could almost say this movie was ahead of its time.
One of the things that struck me about it is, as I was watching it, first of all, Liam Neeson does a very good job of absolutely chewing the scenery in every scene that he's in. I mean, there is if you're watching this and looking for sort of believable, spot-on performances, you're going to be left wondering what in the hell went wrong with this feature. But if you sort of accept the fact that this is sort of a comic book movie tied to a Universal monster movie, and the performances sort of ape that, then you end up walking away with a really enjoyable experience. It's fun to watch Liam Neeson sort of play like this take on the Invisible Man meets the Mummy meets Batman. And that's really one of the enjoyable things about it. I mean, everybody else, is a little over the top. Frances McDormand by far is the most I don't know if underwhelming is the right word, but she seems to be the only one trying to give an honest to God performance that you know that isn't trying to jump out of the screen. Everybody else sort of tries to act themselves out of the screen, with Liam Neeson being far ahead of everyone else. But
superhero
fun.
Movies are very superhero movies are very clearly not Frances McDormand's bag.
No, I don't think she knew what. This is one of those deals where I'm not entirely
sure
she knew what she was supposed to be doing. And you know, Sam Raimi as the director probably it wasn't a big concern of his. It was kind of like George Lucas with every actor. It was like, just read the lines. So here's the plot of this thing, and I'm going to do my best to, because it gets a little convoluted, but I'm going to do my best to sort of, without having to read this verbatim, get through the high points here. So Liam Neeson plays Peyton Westlake, who is a scientist, and he's developing a synthetic skin to help with acid burn victims. His girlfriend is Frances McDormand. She plays Julie Hastings, who is an attorney. The action gets going when she discovers a document called the Belisarius Memorandum, which is an incriminating document proving that corrupt developer Lewis Strack has been bribing members of the Zoning Commission. Fast forwarding a little bit, we have a situation where mobster Robert Durant wants the document, and so they go after Westlake in order to get it. Beat the information out of him, where is this thing? And in doing so, they burn his hands and they dunk his face in acid. He then has a surgery, an operation that they cut the nerves of his spinothalamic tract, so physical pain is no longer felt. However, he also loses his tactile sensation. Removing the sensory input gives him enhanced strength due to adrenal overload, and he keeps his injuries from incapacitating him, but it also drives him batty. So this is where you get sort of that odd performance of his where he's, you know, where he's sort of doing Invisible Man. So his superpowers are basically he's in, you know, he is really strong. He doesn't feel pain for the most part, though they're really inconsistent with that. And the other thing about it is that the synthetic skin that he's developed only lasts for 99 minutes. That basically, if it's in the light, 99 minutes pass by, it turns to soup. So a lot of Dark Man is him putting on these synthetic skin masks and imitating other people, and it's fun, but that's kind of what he does. Otherwise, he's running around in bandages. Moving forward, he decides he's going to take revenge on Durant and all of his people. He thinks he's dead. He ends up revealing that he's still alive. He tries to at one point he's trying to get back with her, and then he realizes that because of his the change in his mental capacity that he's putting her in danger by being with her. So he decides that they can't be together, but she still wants to be with him, and she's willing to accept him as he is and all this other stuff. You know, meanwhile, they've still got these bad guys to deal with. So Strack ends up capturing Julie, and our movie ends basically with first going after Durant, and ultimately, allegedly killing him, and then going after Strack. Which leads to my favorite part of the movie. I have been dying to talk about this. So there's this whole chase scene where they go after Durant, and Durant ends up crashing into, they hook a helicopter to a truck, and I think Durant then crashes into an overpass.
You know, like you do.
Like you do. But my favorite part of this movie, the best part of it, is the movie ends with Strack and Julie luring Dark Man to the ribs of an unbuilt building, the girders. And they're having this final confrontation on the girders. And Strack picks up like a bolt gun and starts firing it at point blank range at Dark Man and misses him every single time except for the very last shot he gets him in the hand. And I'm talking, he is as far away from Liam Neeson as I am from my current computer screen. And I'm like, I can reach it with my hand, ladies and gentlemen. That's how close they are. And he has the accuracy of a Star Wars stormtrooper. All right, he can't hit the broadside of an aircraft carrier with this thing. I love it. It's ridiculous. But moving on. So after he finally he shoots him in the hand. He bolts the hand to one of the girders. Darkman pulls his hand out and ends up, I think, knocking him off the building. Let's see if I'm right about that. Strack calls his bluff by saying killing him would not be something he could live with. Westlake then drops Strack to his death, like a Disney villain, saying to him, I'm learning to live with a lot of things. We get a cameo from Bruce Campbell, and then, the very last line of the movie is, I am everyone and no one, everywhere and nowhere, call me Darkman. And that's where the movie leads. So I've sort of talked about the Universal horror monsters performance of the actors. What was your first take on this film after rewatching it?
God, my first take on it is that Sam Raimi is not a perfect director by any means, but goddamn, when he gets it right, there is no denying how much fun he can make a movie. Just how much pure, unabashed joy he will bring to it without necessarily trying to make high art or something with an elaborate, deeply resonating message. That's everything that made the first two Spider-Man movies so much fun. And that's absolutely the case here because, Liam Neeson just completely goes right at the scenery buffet and totally comes back for second, which is kind of impressive because in researching the role, he had some conversations and some interactions with the Phoenix Society, which is a group dedicated to helping severely disfigured accident victims re-enter society fully adjusted. Then you take that and you pair his absolutely crazed post-accident performance alongside now Oscar winner Frances McDormand, who, by the way, we got to come up with an actual name for this feature because once more, we have a case where we could have possibly had a very different movie had they gone with one of their alternate casting choices. Because they had three other people in mind that they were considering for this role. At one point, Universal was seriously considering Demi Moore. Sam Raimi tested Bridget Fonda but ruled her out because alongside Neeson, she seemed a little bit too young. And last but not least, and this is the big one that might have really made this a totally different movie. Frances McDormand actually was almost passed up in favor of Universal really badly wanting to cast a pretty woman, Julia Roberts. Now you want to talk about somebody I really cannot imagine ever making a superhero movie. By absolutely not, unless somewhere down the line we get about a 6th or 7th attempt to fully reboot the Spider-Man franchise and they need yet another Aunt May. But that's kind of the main interesting casting choices of the whole thing. But overall, it really is a modern, fairly pulpy take on The Shadow. It's like combining the wardrobe and action of The Shadow with the look and feel of Batman, complete with Danny Elfman's score, with maybe just the slightest little bit of that signature Sam Raimi schlock and awe that you get from movies like The Evil Dead.
There was definitely,
Sam,
there was definitely an Evil Dead feel about this movie without it going. It didn't get gross at times, thankfully, at least for my taste. But I could, watching it going, this screams Evil Dead.
It's Sam just having him a good old time, the way you see Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino do.
Yeah.
He's the kind of guy that goes out there and whatever movie he's making, whether it's something like this or The Evil Dead or Spider-Man or Drag Me to Hell, you can tell he's going out there and he's making the kind of movies that he would buy a ticket to see. And really, in the early 90s, those were the very best action movies to watch.
I have to say, on the subject of craft, for $16 million and the kind of movie they were going for here, this isn't a badly put together movie. I mean, I didn't.
No, it's actually a pretty damn good looking one.
I have seen some movies where, you know, I've talked about like one of the Halloween sequels and some other ones where the editing is just shoddy, you know, or the special effects, and we'll get to this with the second two movies, sort of resembled that canned Superman 4, you reuse the same shot over and over again kind of a thing. I mean, you don't really get that. Like, you get the sense that this is supposed to look like an old horror movie without it being shoddily made. Mm-hmm. And I have to give Sam Raimi and the producers credit on that, is they really went the extra mile to give you a feel without risking the craft of the movie.
It really did. I mean, it, like I said, it has kind of that look of early 90s action movies. You can just kind of guess when it was made right off the bat, almost from the very first shots of it. But it also kind of has, another thing it has going for it is it was sort of the right casting at the right time. Because nowadays, if you were to make a superhero movie, especially a totally independent original one, and you were to try to get Liam Neeson for it, oh, God.
You'd end up casting Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah, if but hey-o. if his representation didn't laugh you right out of the room when you even suggested it, paying for him alone would probably bankrupt the rest of your production. But on the other hand, this was getting in when he was a lot younger. It was, like I said, it was pre-Schindler's List, pre-Star Wars, pre-Taken, pre-just about everything else that really comes to mind when you mention it. Same deal with Frances McDormand. You got somebody who was trying to bring a little honest gravity to it, who, as it would turn out, was indeed the definition of Oscar-caliber actress. And it kind of counterbalanced the silliness, offset it, and was sort of the straight lady of the whole thing. Robert Durant is just...
I was going to say, she's almost out of place. Like, she doesn't match with her. She's almost out of place. I mean, I wouldn't say it detracts from the movie, but it's definitely something that's distracting when I'm watching it, because everybody else is sort of playing it one way and she's playing it.
You know what?
It's
a little bit like watching, to kind of make a more modern comparison, it's a little bit like watching Natalie Portman in either of the Thor movies or Gwyneth Paltrow in Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's clearly trying to do so very much, very hard actoring, that it's almost a distraction from how fun and bombastic everything else is.
Right.
All around, how bigger than life it all is. But then you got Durant, which is just such a damn fun villain. With the name that makes him sound like the romantic lead in a telenovela.
Yeah, he is
Robert Durant.
I wish we had Winfrey here just to talk about Durant, because, you know, we talk often on his show about how, you know, we just don't have the kind of mustache twirling, you know, villain for villain's sake and doing villainy things kind of villain out there anymore. You know, we have villains like Ultron, you know, or we have, you know, we have these villains that, you know, they have a plan, but they're not particularly evil. But Durant was it. There's nothing good about him. He just walks on the screen basically maleficent.
Yeah, pretty much. That's about the size of it. He is. I like to think of it as if they had made Marvel's Daredevil for Netflix, and instead of really trying to go the tormented, insecure route that Vincent D'Onofrio did, and instead just have the Kingpin just go straight up early post-Silver Age, that's about how it would have ended up.
Right.
He would have basically been Durant.
and he's great. Which,
now that I think about it, that in itself would actually be kind of abusing.
Well, you know, with too many shows and movies, they always want to make the villain sympathetic in some way. And so you end up, as an audience member, you end up conflicted as, well, who the hell am I supposed to be rooting for here? I mean, as much as Vincent D'Onofrio's portrayal of the Kingpin was out of this world and amazing, you still feel bad for the guy. Whereas, you're rooting for Darkman 100%. You're not rooting for Durant here. And that's the way it's
just. Well, and that's where it's still kind of just enough of an anti-hero movie, in that it doesn't have that underlying element like Spawn or The Crow, where it's where you feel quite as bad for the hero as you do in those. Because in all three movies, in Darkman, The Crow, and Spawn, you have somebody who had some very, very bad things done to them, and then they turn around and did very, very bad things to the bad guy. It's just that the lines aren't quite as ambiguous when it comes to the hero. I mean, like I said, like we've talked about with The Crow before. In that movie, you watch Eric Draven, and after enough viewings, you kind of start to realize he's becoming everything that he's seeking to strike down and not even realize it. He's losing everything that made him a good man in life. Spawn, okay, same kind of deal. Al Simmons is a no-conscience, hell-bent for leather ex-U.S. Marine assassin. And then after he makes a deal with Malbolgia, he comes back and he's got this phenomenal superpowered suit that feeds off kind of the energy of the dead and the energy of evil. But it's at a cost of the more he uses it to kind of meet out his vengeance, the closer he gets to losing his soul to Malbolgia and becoming the ranking general of Hell's Army. In this case, you don't really have stakes quite like that. It's just simply Peyton Westlake had some really shitty things done to him through no fault of anything that he had ever done, and he is just out to just get some murdering done to make up for it. All while he's trying to kind of make his own adjustment. Just kind of watch it and go, you know what? I'll allow it.
But
kill happily.
But what's different about Darkman, another thing that's different than The Crow, if you remember when we talked about the original Crow, it was sort of scene after scene of him murdering this gang of thugs that took out him and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Where Darkman, you know, there's definitely a little bit more going on here. He spends time, you know, because he has to imitate some of these people, like learning their speech patterns and he's got sort of a plan to get revenge. This isn't just a murder spree. But I like the fact that there was the carnival scene. We can talk about that for a little bit. There's a genuine attempt here once he figures out that he can keep the face for longer than 99 minutes, I think if he stays out of the light. And so there's an actual genuine attempt to reconnect with Julie, and everything was going fine until someone tried him. And then, you know, and he lost his temper, and his reaction to it was far beyond what was appropriate for the, I think it was like the carny pissed him off is what happened. You know, and he blew it, and everyone's sort of looking at him like, what are you doing? And then that's when he realizes that he's so changed that he'll actually put this woman in danger if they're still together. That's an element that's missing from both Darkman, from both The Crow and Spawn. There's never really, I mean, you alluded to it with The Crow, but I don't remember Draven ever really having that Jesus moment that Darkman does, where, you know, I'm dangerous to the people around me, and I have to go into isolation of some sort.
Maybe a little bit at the end, but not really actively during the narrative. And when it comes to Spawn, HBO's Spawn did a much better job of conveying that than the movie did. The movie once more didn't really get to that point until the end of it. The show goes into much greater depth of exploring the consequences and the danger that Al's actions are putting Wanda and oh God, I forget his name. What's his name's child again? Or child into. But the movie, no, not really so much.
So we have about a little less than 30 minutes left for this show. Anything else about the original Darkman? I mean, we've talked about craft. We talked about the look of it, the performances. If I say the movie is fun one more time, I'm sure someone's going to find me and hit me. So, I will say this. I don't think you could make a movie like Darkman today. I mean, I think you could, but it would be like a YouTube movie. I don't see studios giving a young director, you know, young Sean Comer, young Mark Ratledge, young Robert Winfrey, you know, $16 million to go out and, you know, go make your low budget dream feature. You know, be creative. And here's why. Give me a few minutes to sort of talk about the business of movies today. The Avengers, according to Disney, was a failure. Okay? Age of Ultron. This thing made over $1 billion, but because it didn't make more than the original Avengers for one reason or another, they're considering it not a flop, but as far as projected sales and whatnot, it didn't hit the mark that it was supposed to. So it's a failure. Jurassic World was the biggest movie of the summer by over $1 billion. When you're thinking about, like, what the studios are putting out there now, sure, you have your art house movies and you have your Oscar nominees, but they're banking on known properties. So it's like I just when you think that, you know, someone goes to Universal or Fox or Disney and says, hey, I want to create this thing out of whole cloth, this crazy idea I have in the back of my head, some sketches that I've done, I want to bring this to life, and, you know, and here's my budget, what do you think? They're gonna go, why? between Marvel and DC, we got this covered, and those are known entities, and they're all going to make millions of dollars, so, you know, piss off. So it's like, if you want to go out there and make that movie, by no means am I saying you shouldn't go out there and do it, but, you know, you're going to have to be like a Kevin Smith, which is basically put the shit on your credit card and go shoot it in your backyard. Because I just don't see the modern movie marketplace in terms of studios getting behind getting behind original concepts.
Well, it's not even original. It's not even just original concepts. I mean, it's the fact that it has to be a pretty damn bankable property for the most part. I mean, hell, look at, let alone whether it's original or adapted, look at the fight that Marvel has had on its hands just trying to get a movie made that's based entirely on a female superhero. In an interview recently, Kevin Feige, Kevin Feige-Quad, was saying that because Marvel just recently came fully under the Disney umbrella, they are fully under their under Disney's supervision now. And Kevin was saying that that was actually one of the things that stopped him from quitting not that long ago, because he was having just ongoing back-and-forth battles with the then Marvel studio head, whose approach seemed to be demand more, demand bigger, but cut the budgets. And in addition, was also adamant about cutting back the emphasis on merchandising characters like Scarlet Witch and Black Widow, because as he out and out told Kevin Feige-Quad, he said female superhero toys don't sell.
I got it.
Girls don't buy superheroes.
Let me just jump in here real quick. That is such a bunch of crap. And actually, it actually makes me angry, because I can't tell you how many, my daughter, who's all of 4 years old, doesn't, anything that's boy related, she will tell me, those are for boys, that's not for me. When she plays Disney Infinity, she plays as Gamora, or she plays as Black Widow, or she plays as one of the Disney princesses. I mean, her first, like, comic book toy that she picked up, you know, I just said, here's a bunch of comic book toys at a comic book store that we went into. Pick one, and I'll buy it for you. She picks up Electro, of all people.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, in my four-year-old's head, girls are for girls and boys are for boys. So, like, there's this whole marketplace, because I don't think my daughter's really that abnormal in that belief at 4 years old. That there's a whole marketplace out there that they're just ignoring. I guarantee you, there's girls out there that are looking for girl superheroes. That's a bunch of crap.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and it's one of the few areas where I would say that DC and Warner Brothers is actually kind of coming out ahead of Marvel, is the fact that Wonder Woman is going to hit theaters before Captain Marvel is going to.
Oh, never mind that. Do you know how many toys and how much Harley Quinn is going to be all over the place when Suicide Squad comes out?
Oh, God. Who was it? I want to say it was, I think it was Ben that posted on one of my statuses earlier today. He said Harley Quinn is starting to reach Daredevil levels of overexposure, or not Daredevil, Deadpool levels of overexposure.
But I'll tell you,
he's absolutely right at this point.
The last Comic-Con I went to, the two most often cosplayed characters were Deadpool and Harley Quinn. So, there you go. But just to reiterate, I don't see, outside of maybe an independent sort of, you know, doing it, you know, on their own, I don't see a studio-backed original concept like Darkman being made in 2015, 2016. I don't think that sort of thing. And it's sad, because I enjoy movies where I can see sort of the joy that the director put into it. I mean, I know everyone shits on The Hobbit, but at the very least, I get the sense that Peter Jackson, you know, these were labors of love. Never mind Lord of the Rings, which is damn near perfect. But at least, you know, like I said, everyone shits on The Hobbit, but at least I get the sense he enjoyed making those movies. So for better or for worse, at least I know while watching them that I'm watching somebody who really took care into making them. And that's part of the reason why I enjoy Darkman, is like I get that this came from his mind and this was his baby, and that made it that much more enjoyable. But let's close the book on the original here, and let's talk about the sequels. What can one say? Well, as you said before, they released them out of order. And the only thing I have to say about Darkman, about either, and this goes for both of them, but since I find something to say about Darkman too, I don't understand how Durant came back to life. He fucking hit in a helicopter. He hit an overpass and blew up. But whatever. Maybe he jumped out of the last second.
Deadites.
I don't even think it's even explained in the movie how he survived.
You know what? No, there was a missed opportunity by not claiming that Deadites resurrected Durant.
Yeah, he just appears. Both the Return of Durant and Die, Dark Man Die are shot like, do you remember the movies that used to play at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon on whatever your Fox affiliate was? You know,
the WGN lunchtime movie.
Yeah, that's exactly what these look like. And right down to the background score, which was charming for Die, Dark Man, Die, because that actually has a fun plot to it. But the Return of Durant, on my kid's life without reading the Wikipedia page, I couldn't tell you what the plot of that movie was. No fucking clue. I just feel like it was, you know, Arnold Vosloo over for Liam Neeson, doing his best Liam Neeson impression of Darkman, and it was yet another kill all of Durant's people movie.
You know what? And actually, fuck that noise for just a moment, because, you know, Bruce Campbell is one of those guys that I think you would almost have a harder time talking him out of making some movies than you would have talking him into starring in it. That guy, for some of the great stuff he has starred in, he has starred in some shit. what was it? I'm trying to remember now. Times like this, I almost wish I could phone up Allison Pregler and ask her, because she reviewed this on Obscure Sleuper Presents. It was a sci-fi original movie that he agreed to star in under the condition that sci-fi financed one of his other movies that he wanted to get made. He's just an average Joe who just totally loves being an actor. It's a craft to him, but it's also fun. He's still very much, I think, that same guy who was driving a cab before Sam called him up and said, "Hey, you got to come make Evil Dead." That being said, when you have him right at the end of the first movie as the new face of Darkman, literally, how do you not just beg him however you have to come and do the sequel and instead go with Arnold Vosloo? No, how do you instead just divert right to the guy from Hard Target?
Let's see, Arnold Vosloo, whose last picture he did was 2015, Grimm, the television series, 2014, Crisis, the television series. He's also been in Odd Thomas, the Elementary, and he was Zartan in G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Yep. Well, and he was also Imhotep in The Mummy and The Mummy Returns.
That's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, okay, that's a good one. That's a good one to picture. The guy from The Mummy, that's your new Darkman. You had Bruce Campbell, and you went with this one.
That's fantastic.
We've joked about it before. This is like someone has put the idea of Bryan Cranston playing Lex Luthor in your head, and instead of Heisenberg, you go with Eisenberg.
Yep. The red capes are coming. The red capes are coming.
And all love to him. He does his best in everything. I don't actively have a problem with him. It's just you had Bruce Campbell.
Well, clearly these weren't even good enough for Bruce Campbell to consider bothering with it. Though, so I don't know why he didn't want to do Die Dark Man Die. Die Dark Man Die. So we only have about little less than 15 minutes left, and we still got to do plugs and whatnot. I want to keep a tight hour since I still have I have to clean a house, and Sean's got work to do. So let me just say this: the plot of this movie is actually pretty fun. It's supposed to take place after the events of the original Dark Man. And remember how I said before, it has that Superman 4 feel to it, where they keep reusing the same shot. Well, it's like they took a page out of the old 1970s Incredible Hulk show. And the sequence of events that show the Hulk hulking out, and they just reuse it every episode. They kind of did the same thing here. Whenever Darkman has a Hulk out moment, it goes through this this array of quick edited scenes that end with him being blown. Looks terrible. The him being blown up and all this other stuff happening.
Now I'm suddenly imagining like a low budget Darkman anime. where they have so little money that to depict movement, it's just constant stills of Dark Man with whizzing motion lines behind him.
That basically is what it was. they do that a bunch of times throughout the movie. Whenever he hulks out, and he does hulk out, like there's one where they have him tied up in chains, and it goes to the exact sequence as I've described it, and he rips the chains out with his bare hands.
And you know what? How off is my thought process when you talk about him hulking out, and I just some wires and some synapses get crossed somewhere in my head, and I instantly start thinking, you mean at one point he drops the big leg on Durant?
We might as well have. We have a new villain. We have a new villain in this one, and this one's interested in selling steroids, and the plot is basically. Him and his mistress, who looks like Patricia Arquette, want to capture Dark Man. They want to experiment on him and draw from him the same abilities that gave him super strength. Well, they want it so that they can sell basically a super steroid out on the street. There's this entire subplot where, and this is funny to me, and it was interesting they wrote this into the movie. There's a subplot here where, his mistress, right, is also a scientist that's experimenting on Darkman. Well, he's got a wife. He's got a kid. He's mean to the wife and kid. But, like, instead of just kind of showing that as an example of why he's unsympathetic and he's a giant bag of dicks, it's an elongated subplot of the movie where there's a point where Darkman takes on him, his face, and he's, like, really nice to the daughter. And the daughter gives him a present, and the wife's like, are you trying to take my daughter from me by being nice all of a sudden? And then he shows up to the kid's play, and then he almost falls in love with the wife and the kid, and that takes on a whole life of its own. And I have to say, as a dad, I'm sure this is, going to get me, someone's going to want to punch me, but I liked the scenes with him and the daughter. And maybe to other people it's like, oh my God, this is so maudlin. But to me it was like, yeah, when a kid like looks at you and she thinks it's his dad, so let's just go with that. The kid looks at you and you're the dad, and there's nothing quite like that feeling of unadulterated love, and it changes this guy who in the previous movie thought he was just an absolute monster and a danger to everybody around him, and this kid melts his cold heart, and I'm like, oh, that's great. What an odd thing to throw into this movie, though. It just comes out of left.
I like that. I kind of like that. I kind of wish they would have. That was a nice focal point to have mm-hmm. there.
Because it's a long stretch.
And I
of
think
movie.
That's.
There's a whole segment of this movie where he's not killing anybody. He's dealing with his family and his sort of. And there's even a scene where he's in his like hideout where he's like, all I care about is my work. I don't care about anybody. And then badly changes direction. It's just like but I care about her. I don't know what to do.
We've talked about this before with superhero sequels, where we've talked about how the first movie sets up the origin. This is obviously assuming, of course, that you've started with an origin story. Good examples. We'll use, like, say, Iron Man and Spider-Man. You have the first two movies that set up how the character came to be. The second movie, you have the characters struggling with how their powers have redefined them and trying to get a grasp of who they really are in this new role, usually because something or other has come along to call that into question. In Iron Man 2, it's the fact that Tony has palladium poisoning, and he's realizing, all things considered, I really only have so long left to live, and there's nothing I can do about it. What kind of man do I want to be in this time I have left? In Spider-Man 2, you have Peter's powers and his responsibility to them, his obligation to them, all of a sudden costing him everything that he loves in his life, and then all of a sudden losing his powers because, meh. and he finds his life redefined again, and he finds himself kind of seduced by normalcy. But ultimately, he has even that called into question, and he has to make his choice, just like Tony kind of has to make his choice about who he wants to be and what the purpose of being Iron Man is. Well, so it kind of is in this case, and I doubt that's kind of what Sam ever originally intended when he conceived this story, but it's Peyton Westlake all of a sudden realizing kind of what it's still possible for him to have, what there's still hope for, and kind of rediscovering that spark of a hope of having a prayer of finding some sort of stability, of some real happiness. And it kind of, and unfortunately, kind of in this trilogy, again, as it was with Spider-Man and Iron Man, the third movie ends up boiling down to something that doesn't feel remotely as significant. And that doesn't feel as weighty and involving and like it expands on the character quite as much. Because obviously, had they been released in order, the third movie in this series would have been The Return of Durant, which is just going right back to Darkman versus Durant. And it just kind of feels like a step backward instead of a step forward. It feels like a retread. So I think that's why what should have been the second movie worked so well, and why, damn it, it should have just been released when it was intended to be.
No, agreed. The other thing I liked about the movie was, you know, normally, you know, whenever you're dealing with a drug kingpin or whatever, it's always like coke or heroin, you know. Rarely it's pop, but it's almost never steroids. And there was some really odd like plot elements in there.
No, that's reserved for shitty plot threads on Arrow and Gotham.
Ugh.
I heard that cringe.
There's this like subplot in there with the district attorney, I think it is, which ends up being like the final scene in the movie. it's just weird. Like his motivation to do bad things is a little oddball, and not oddball in a bad way. It was almost refreshing to see a new take on that kind of a bad guy, which is almost cut and paste. So overall, if you're ever running like a marathon night and you want sort of a fun take on universal horror monster / comic book movies, you could do far worse than the Darkman trilogy. Not nearly as dark as The Crow, and I actually think in a lot of ways, especially with the sequels, better made than The Crow sequels. But we talked those movies to death, so I'm not going back over that again.
Let's not.
All right. So calendar of events, and then we'll get on out of here. I want to appreciate those of you who took a little bit of time to listen to us at our redo time today. But we will be back. We will be back in We will be back on September 23rd. We will be at Highlander. We'll be looking at Highlanders 1 and 2. And then we'll be... Now, we're going to do two back-to-back episodes. Now, that's a special Wednesday episode because the 24th is my wife's birthday and I'm not allowed to do podcasts on her birthday. So we're going to record on the 23rd instead. So that's Highlander 1 and 2, September 23rd. On October 1st, we'll finish up with Highlander. We'll look at movies 3, 4, and 5. And we'll probably go back to our usual two-hour time. There we go. October 15th, we look at Jaws, Parts 1 and 2. And then on the 29th, right before Halloween, we'll look at Jaws 3 and 4. And so that's the next two shows. And as we get closer to November, we'll reveal what we're I had a whole list of movies that I wanted to do, but we had a little kind of a long break throughout the summer, so we're a little off schedule from where I wanted to be. But I still wanted to look at The Hobbit. I want to look at Lord of the Rings. I had a whole bunch of stuff in there. I will say this.
You know what? This has been the most clusterfucky year at times.
One thing I did, and I don't know if I told Sean about this, but the week that Spectre comes out, we're actually going to do a Long Road to Ruin look at just the Daniel Craig Bonds. And so then the following week, we'll review Spectre when that comes out. But, yep, that's where we are right now. The 23rd is our next show. We'll be looking at Highlander. And then the following week on Thursday, Highlander again, 3 and 4, and then Jaws. So
I just had this nagging feeling that the first Highlander show is going to be 30 minutes of us gushing about what a great cult classic Highlander is, and then just an hour of just utter disbelief and weeping at just how absolutely incomprehensible the theatrical cut of Highlander 2 was.
Real quick, just I want to plug my other show and then let Sean have his last words. Next Thursday, I've also been taking a break from the Metal Hammer of Doom. Like I said, as Sean said, it's been kind of a wonky summer. But I'm coming back.
I believe the word I used was clusterfucky, thank you.
Yeah, yes, it was clusterfucky and wonky. But back in I got my head clear. I'm ready to get going again on some fun podcasts. So the Metal Hammer of Doom returns, and I gave Robert Cooper an early Christmas present. We're going to skip Five Finger Death Punch because if they can't be bothered to release the whole album on Spotify, I can't be bothered covering it. Therefore, we're going to skip Five Finger Death Punch, we're going to skip Lamb of God, and we're going to go right to Slayer, Repentless. We'll be looking at that on September 17th, and then we'll be looking at the new Clutch on October 8th. And on October 22nd, not really sure what we're going to be doing. I know the new Children of Bodom comes out October 2nd. It's probably going to end up doing that. So that's all for now. That's what we got going, and we'll figure out what we're doing with the rest of the year when the rest of the year comes. All right, Sean, anything in the works that you want to talk about? Anything you want to plug?
Nothing quite yet. I mean, like Mark and I both said, this has been a very weird year for our show. We've had so many shows get put off, so many that I think weren't quite what we wanted them to be. It's been turbulent as hell, and I'll shoulder a lot of the responsibility for that. Basically, I'm just kind of wanting us to sort of really just ride out this last quarter of 2015 and then just really just come back with a nuclear bang in 2016, because I'm going to be moving in a couple of months to what is going to finally be kind of the final form of the Fortress of Shaunitude for a while. I'm kind of in the last stages of some personal maintenance and kind of some repairs and rebuilding that I've had to do. But we've got some good stuff coming to close out 2015. I've been really excited to get to the Highlander franchise for a while. And there's a bunch more ahead of us that I know we haven't gotten to yet. God, just so many that I've got them all up in my head, and I just can't name just one that I'm most excited about. But coming up in 2016, I realize it's just September now, but we've got some new podcasts coming. We've got some hopefully new features coming. You and I were talking before the show, and I feel like we can tell everybody right now that coming in November, we're going to do a 4-week review hosted by yours truly. Shut up, I promise I'll get it right this time. In which we are going to be reviewing the full run, the full premiere season of Marvel's AKA Jessica Jones on Netflix. And I'm personally going to be trying to recruit Ben Colon and Cole Marinette and maybe even Jesse Starcher to come on the show with us and really share the joy. I'd love to do some more music and gaming related stuff coming up in the near future. But it's all contingent kind of just on how the rest of the year goes. We love doing these shows. Mark and I think that when the day comes that it's just consistently no longer fun for us and starts to feel too much like a job on an ongoing basis, I think that's pretty much when we're done. Fortunately, we are nowhere near that point yet. We just kind of got to the points where we knew what we had to do to make doing this fun full time again. And we're doing that. And it's going to be a good end of 2015. And it's going to be a fantastic start to 2016, I'm saying right now. So everybody, thank you for listening every single week. You can find me on either of my Facebook accounts. Go ahead and shoot me a line at Sean Comer or at Sean Colin Comer. You can find me on Twitter at Canvas Content. Anytime you should so choose to. I always love to hear from you guys. I'm always down to chat as long as I've got a minute. And in the meantime, we will be seeing you hopefully on a consistent basis again over the course of the next month or so.
All right. For Sean, I'm your mandated reporter, Mr. Mark Rattledge. Be well, be safe, behave, and hail the apocalypse.